was his first name? Chester? Charles? It began with a C. I don't remember. We didn't use first names.
Did you work on the Rockaways project together as well as teaching?
No. I did some other kind of research. Although I did teach many courses, I did not have that much time for other kinds of research. Jerome was, of course, employed full-time doing that sort of thing. There were some student assistants that he had who did a lot of the routine preparation of samples.
Can you tell me something about the work you were doing with Rockaway then?
Yes. There were two kinds of projects. One was an attempt to protect ship hulls from corrosion, and another project concerned boundary lubrication.
Where was the support for these? Was that NRL support?
It was an NRL project. And that's how I, in a sense, became acquainted with the Naval Research Lab and led to our coming here 2 years after we joined
this
people
was,
in Ann Arbor.
And this was through work being done by William Sisman?
Yes. Yeah, I became an employee of the Naval Research Laboratory. Even though the work was being done at the University of Michigan, my employment actually started in 44.
Mm-hmm. What was this research like? Did you find it interesting? Was it useful to you?
It was quite useful to me. In fact, I wrote some very interesting texts about it after the war.
In fact, you continued it here after the war.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I used extensions of what I had learned as a graduate student and techniques that I had learned as a graduate student. The fact that professionally it was an opportunity for me to broaden my knowledge of my specialty.
Before we move on to NRL, I wanted to ask Isabella something about her teaching. I'm curious about that, so I want to pick up on one question there before we... Were there many others in this group with Rockaway working on these projects, the NRL project?
There was another man at my level, and then there was young woman who was also helping him, and then we had some youngsters from the school who assisted us in hand computing, which was the only kind of computing there was in those days. Little desktop multiplier.
Use Friedan calculator?
Exactly. Yes. Marchand Friedan. Yes.
Yes. Remember those?
Yes.
You were doing electron diffraction research for the NRL at the time, I believe.
Yes.
Were you making your own electron diffraction equipment at Michigan also?
Yes.
And I understand that the NRL had contracted out all its electron diffraction work to the University of Michigan. Do you have any recollection of this?
You mean before I came here?
During the war period.
Yes, that could very well be. As I think I mentioned the last time we got together, But while I was still a graduate student, Lawrence Brockway had a contract with the Willow Road Bomber Plant to help them with welding. And one summer, I built an electron diffraction apparatus to do the work, and the next summer I did the work. Mm-hmm. So building electron diffraction equipment was the only thing feasible if you wanted to do that kind of experiment. Mm-hmm.
The one that was built here was built on a different principle, much more advanced than the ones we had used either in graduate school or the one he built at the welding project.
Specially designed the ones here when we came. They actually built two of us according to the same design. They had a marvelous machine shop here and did a very fine job for us. But we, from what we learned about the technique, had a number of plans for improving the experimentation and also the analysis. And so the apparatus that we built here was much more advanced than was currently available in the United States. Some of the advances that we put in had already been made in Norway, where they had have always had a very fine group. There's still, there are still several laboratories there that do very fine work in gas electron diffraction.
I was going to ask you if there were any others outside of Norway and what you were doing in the United States. Was there any other group?
At the time, yes. Well, there was some in Japan. I did mention that.
Yes, but they never did the gas work there in Japan.
In Japan?
No.
Sure, Marino.
Oh, that was afterwards.
You mean after the war?
After the war.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, they did. They did a little bit of gas work during the war, I think, as well. But I can't be absolutely sure about that. But they improved their facilities greatly after the war. There was some work done in the Soviet Union. Pinsker did some. I can't say exactly what the date was that they started. The British became interested in it after the war. The very first experiments were done in Germany at about the time that Pauling was carrying out his I guess it was a sort of a sabbatical around 1929 and 30. And he brought back the thought that this might be a possible technique. And Brockway, his graduate student, developed it. The first experiments were done by Hermann Mark, who was very famous as a polymer chemist. He had an associate by the name of Wierl, W-I-E-R-L. They did the first experiments, but neither of them was interested in pursuing the technique, but they showed that it could work. There were a number of people working in the field of gas electron diffraction who did themselves in various accidents for some reason, and Wierl was killed not too many years after in a motorcycle accident. There was a
These were laboratory accidents.
There were very few people working in the field, and the number of catastrophes that were associated were really disproportional. Hmm. Curious thing.
Do you speculate upon that at all?
No. I think it's... well, maybe working in the field took a certain amount of adventurism. That would bring people into circumstances that were a little more dangerous than otherwise.
Any other, I'm curious about this point, if you don't mind my pursuing it for a moment. What other kinds of accidents befell other workers?
Well, there was an automobile accident. I forget the names of the people, some young people who were working in California. Another unfortunate gentleman got a brain tumor. I don't remember what happened. I think this other man became ill, who took a job here at the University of Maryland in the early 50s.
Yes.
Yeah, he became ill and died.
There was another young man in Germany who got a mental illness, and his papers had to be retracted by the university for a number of years.
Yeah. All right. And I can't think. There may have been one or two others, but I.
Was it Spur or Shand from California?
It was Spur who was here at Maryland who became ill. And I think something happened to Shand also.
Well, I think that was the automobile accident.
That was the automobile.
I'm not sure, but I think so.
Right.
I think it was Shand who was involved in that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, considering there were maybe 15 or 20 people in the field, it was getting decimated almost faster.
The electron diffraction of vapors just didn't persist in Germany, even though it started there. Hermann Mark came to this country soon afterwards and turned to polymers.
Yeah, well, he wasn't interested in pursuing it anyway.
And then the few people who didn't survive.
Why would you guess that electron diffraction developed in the centers that it did develop, in the United States, in Norway, and a few in Japan? Were there any specific professional or institutional reasons for that, as opposed to Germany or France, say?
It's very hard to say. I think that in part it was connected with professional interests, but also personalities. Pauling was interested in it as a tool in addition to spectroscopy for getting good information about the geometric structure of molecules. At the same time, he was developing his quantum mechanical calculations for attempting to predict what these structures would be. So his interest would be quite obvious. Why specifically an interest developed in Norway? It developed, I believe, among people who were interested in organic chemistry. And there is, of course, an obvious connection between doing structural work and synthetic organic chemistry in terms of identification, but more than that, having a three-dimensional picture of what it is that you're working with. At least one of the people was quite interested in this and did a lot of work on how hydrogen atoms would be directed in things like cyclohexane, for example. His name was Hassel, Odd Hassel. He received Nobel Prize, as a matter of fact, for that work, and he shared it with Derek.
Derek Bart.
So Derek Bart.
Yes.
But there are organic chemists in Germany too. So why they were not quite as interested in that perspective, I don't know. There was gas electron diffraction work in the Bice laboratory, and his son, as a matter of fact, made a contribution to improving the method for gathering data.
That's P.P. Dubai.
Yeah, the son. Not P.J.W. Dubai was certainly interested in it because he was one of the founders of the theory as to how you interpret diffraction from gas mm-hmm. molecules.
In fact, when he came to Cornell from Germany, he brought along with him the electron diffraction unit that he had built, or had built in yes. Germany. I don't know whether he had done it or someone else for him.
But he actually brought the unit with him?
Yes, it's we saw, well, it was quite some time ago. We saw it
In the late 40s
at Cornell. They had it stored in a room, not in a museum type room, but in a room. It was rather small compared to the size unit that we built in the beamline of the well, we had many controls on the voltage.
The first attempts mm-hmm. were made to use X-rays. Mm-hmm. But the scattering of X-rays from gases is practically nil. The experiments were very poor. Now, I suppose if you use synchrotron sources with the various devices for even enhancing that radiation, you might be able to do gas diffraction again. But the electrons were scattered so much more strongly that they became the method of choice by far. It's possible to get a diffraction photograph in a matter of a fraction of a second. Mm. Confining a gas for 2 days. You couldn't use a nozzle, you know. You just had to have it in some sort of a closed container. The container would scatter as much or more than the gas in it and all that sort of thing. It was really a nuisance. It didn't work out.
For the X-rays.
For the X-rays.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the difficulty in building the apparatus may have been the determining factor?
Yes.
In
yes, I think it was limited in part because it was not so difficult to build. The ideas have more or less been established for doing it, and if nothing else, you could copy what someone else did. But in those days, it was more expensive to do that and time-consuming to do that than to do test tube chemistry. So I think that played a role. I have that impression personally because this is what I had to offer in my background when I went around to universities to interview for jobs. And one of the immediate considerations that came up, question I was asked, how much do you think it will cost to build such an apparatus? So this lay heavily mm-hmm. on people's minds.
Yes.
It was, for those days, a complex instrument that would mm-hmm. be costly.
Well, I think there was also another matter. You had to dabble in electronics because all of electronics was built by us or by whomever built the instrument. You had to dabble in building high vacuum pumps. It wasn't until we came to the laboratory here that they were
became commercially
available. Before that, they had to be built mm-hmm. in the university shop, and whoever wanted the high vacuum had to tell the man in the shop exactly how to do it or do it himself. There weren't any plans available. There was a matter of high voltage and measuring it accurately so you know what wavelength you were working at. That was a problem. Keeping an instrument at a high vacuum.
Yes.
So there were many different facets besides doing the experiment itself.
There were many technical difficulties. And
there was no help from the outside. I mean, you had to be adventurous and do
yes.
it yourself.
Yeah, I think that's quite true. And a number of these techniques were simply not in the background of chemists.
What impact would you say this had upon your research and your work, as opposed to students who are now doing research in chemistry or physics, were they more likely to be able to buy their equipment to afford it?
There was a time when gas electron diffraction apparatus became commercially available in Japan and in Switzerland. I think that it's possible now to still order one from Switzerland, but it would be quite expensive because they're not being made except to order. I don't know what the situation in Japan is. There has not been a growth of this field, so that there has not been a new market at all.
I think if I understood your question, though, you were asking how students are trained differently now in that there are so many commercial instruments available, and all they have to do, and this may not be easy, but all they have to do is write a grant to get enough money to buy a commercial instrument. I think they can do many things with it, which they would have to spend a lot of time otherwise developing an instrument, which is good. On the other hand, I think they lose something in creativity and understanding of the process that goes on in the instrument itself. I mean, what is it actually that happens when you put in your sample here and get your result out over there, which is now often in the form of a photograph or a graph written out on a piece of paper.
But you were of a generation that, as a generation, you did this kind of experimentation on your own from a young age. The early days of radio, talking to people who built their own radio, that kind of, but today's students don't do that. They don't have to get into that kind of detail in building, and so there is something lost, I guess.
Yes, I quite agree with what Isabella said. In addition to that, another aspect of it is the computer program, and there are certainly two sides to the computer program situation. One is it affords a facility to a much broader range of workers. That's very good. On the other hand, it's also used as a black box type operation, such that students come up with answers, but they don't have the slightest idea how they come up. And when they run into difficulties, they don't know what to do with the programs, the computer programs. Now, certainly in educational institutions that have that in mind, they can make sure that students do indeed learn how to do things and not hand them everything. I have no idea from statistics to what extent this is done, or whether young professors are in a hurry to get answers and don't care too much about how well the students learn what they should be learning. So I think that you probably get a spectrum of very careful training to that which does nothing more but make super technicians out of young people and hand them PhDs. So it's something to be very careful of, and something we feel very strongly about. Any number of times we will be met by young people who are starting out in our particular field and don't know us, find out that we're in the structure field, supposed to do crystal structures, you know, crystallography and so forth. The first question, what program do you use? And that is the wrong question.
So if I'm understanding you right, you would agree that actually having to produce the apparatus to conduct the experimentation gives you a broader grasp of the physical principles underlying the work than you would achieve otherwise.
In fact, if it's of the correct complexity, you get an appreciation for apparatus and experimental work in general that is very, very important. Again, talking about another aspect of programs and computing and so forth, we feel that there has been a trend toward substituting computers for laboratory work to an extent that is extremely dangerous. We certainly have no qualms about theory and theoretical work, find it very attractive and so forth. To the extent, however, that it's used to replace experimentation, that can make a tremendous amount of trouble. We've had experiences with some young people again. In one instance, we were at a meeting looking at posters, and Isabella spotted that some work that was purely theoretical was inconsistent with experiments that she had done. She attempted to tell this person that, and this person would have none of it. The theory and the calculations came out this way.
And
don't tell me the fact. This is the way it has to be. This is an extreme case, but we witness this, and we see a great deal of it. And this is, of course, a danger. So, starting out with using a computer in which wasn't even electrified, which you had to crank by hand, building your own apparatus, doing your own glass blowing, puts certain appreciations and certain cautions into one's development that I think, if nothing else, are quite protective as life goes on in the scientific world.
How do you see the preparation of the young people coming into this facility?
It's a little hard for me to really give a statistically accurate impression, because I have essentially not hired anyone for the last 20 or so years. I just developed a very stable group, and it's been with me. So I cannot speak firsthand. I can't grade the relative quality of PhD people coming out now. About the only thing that I see in brief contacts at various types of meetings with young people is that I find too often that they're too much dedicated to the use of programs and to the use of the computer, where a certain amount of handwork and a certain amount of understanding that would come from the handwork and an appreciation of the difference between theory and experiment would be quite worthwhile. One has to hesitate a little bit to always say, well, the good old days, why we were better than everything. But I think that certain tendencies of the sort that I've been just discussing have been coming to the fore.